Okay, the next argued case is number 17-1410, Alta Wind against the United States. Mr. Weiner.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Andy Weiner for the United States. Section 1603 provides a payment in lieu of a tax credit based on a taxpayer's basis in eligible property, which includes equipment and other tangible property of a qualified wind farm facility. Plaintiffs in this case purchased wind farm businesses, including all of the tangible and intangible property.
Could I understand what your position has been? Unfortunately, Parsons' testimony expert report is not in the appendix. How did he calculate this? That he obviously provided evidence which was excluded as to the cost basis for the tangibles. How did he calculate that?
So he used the cost method with respect to the eligible property, and he determined the cost method based on based on what taxpayers claim the costs were. I mean, what plaintiffs claim the costs were, plus.
But what was he using, fair market value to determine the value of the tangible assets?
The intangible or the tangible? I'm sorry,
the
Your
tangible
Honor.
Asset.
Tangible. No, he used the costs that were reported by the plaintiffs. So not the replacement value. The costs that were reported by the plaintiffs in terms of what they what it cost them to install the equipment, plus a developer profit and turnkey components.
Original cost of acquiring the property, for example, the turbines?
Well, yes. He then backed out a couple of costs that they had, but yes, he started with the basis of using their cost reporting. He backed out a couple of things because their costs were actually not necessarily out-of-pocket costs. They included the cost of acquisition of a bunch of property from Alco, which they acquired the wind farms from, and that included its own developer profit and turnkey component. So we had to back that out.
Simplified things in my mind, is it essentially collecting up all the receipts of the costs of this, that, and the other that the plaintiffs had to undertake in order to put these wind farms together?
I mean, that would be what KPMG presumably did in vouching for these are the costs that they incurred. And then on top of that, Dr. Parsons, added a developer profit and turnkey component based on market data. How much would a developer demand as a reasonable rate of return to install and build this equipment before the sale?
But before we go a little deeper, and we're gonna have to go deep, can you explain to me just how all your different theories interact? You have the residual method, you have this peculiar circumstances, and then you have the cost method, which was, I assume, what Parsons was going to be testifying to. How do all those interact? Are they, in your view, alternative theories for cutting down what the basis is, or at least what the basis was found to be?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. There are two basic theories that we have in order that we think compel reversal in this case. One is that the taxpayers did not follow the residual method and determine the fair market value of the individual assets they acquired. They backed into that number by saying, we're going to start with the purchase price.
No, we understand that, but okay. I want to know how your theories interact with each other.
Okay.
Are they alternative theories? Are they stacked on each other?
No,
if Parsons gets to testify, then does that mean that the trial judge is put to the test to try to figure out whether it's the sale price or the Parsons cost method that is the right way to determine the basis?
Yeah, the way this trial should have happened is the court should have found that 1060 applies, so the residual method. So that means you got to classify you got to characterize all your assets by class, asset class. So you would a lot of the tangible assets here would be under class 5. You would have to value those assets on an asset by asset, on an individual basis. And then
Using fair market value?
You would have to determine what the fair market value of those assets were. And there would be competing expert testimony with respect to that.
Is that your basic position, that whichever method you use, what you ask is what's the fair market value of the assets?
Yes, the fair market value of the assets is what is required. The 1060 says that you determine which class the asset falls in, and then the amount that you allocate to that particular asset is going to be capped by its fair market value. And so you would have a fight over what's the fair market value. Because so we would say that it would be a cost plus a developer and turnkey value component. And they say, no, it's just whatever the purchase price is.
But I guess what I'm trying to figure out is that cost method, you know, the costs of the tangible assets plus profit plus turnkey value, is that independent in an independent separate lane from your residual method theory?
No, because in order to apply the residual method, as I said, you have to figure out what the residual method, maybe it would be helpful to explain sort of where the residual method comes from to, I think, provide some useful way to see how it applies in this case. The residual method came from this idea that because of intangible property and unidentifiable assets, such as goodwill and going concern value, are so hard to value, what would happen is taxpayers would shoehorn as much value in the assets that they saw most beneficial and ignore the assets that they saw as least beneficial. You can't, at one point in time, you couldn't amortize goodwill and going concern value. So what would happen? Taxpayers would shoehorn all the value into the tangible assets and basically say that we weren't purchasing the business for anything. We were just buying a bunch of assets. And so Congress said, listen, let's short-circuit a lot of these disputes. Let's keep the government from getting whipsawed because purchasers and sellers would both allocate assets differently because they had competing interests in that regard. And so what would happen was, under the residual method that Congress mandated, it said, listen, we want you to start with the easiest assets. Class one is cash. Take cash off the board. And so you start with your purchase price, you deduct out the cash, and then you're left with, you know, this is called the waterfall method for a reason. You have a certain bucket that captures the cash, and so you move on to class two, and then class three. And each time, the amount of the purchase price gets smaller and smaller until you're left with potentially a residual at the end.
Does the cash grant that comes from Treasury count as class one cash?
No.
Okay.
No. No, because that's something that actually was not part of the transaction. That they 1603.
I guess it depends on how you define the transaction, though.
Well, the 1603, the purchase price, did not include
a component. Under your theory of the fair market value of the tangible assets, whatever value was attributable to the grant would not be included as part of the value of the asset, right?
Correct.
So the 1060, that this waterfall regulation, puts the tangible assets in class 5, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't tell you, does it, to use fair market value?
It does tell you to determine based on fair market. So the regulations talk about the regulations under 1060-1, I believe, talk about allocation method, and it refers back to the regulations under 338. And 338-6 and 7-6 and -7 talk about how the allocation to the individual assets is capped at the fair market value. And so that's how the residual method works within each class.
So to be sure that I understand, the government's position is that the basis is limited to what it costs for the machinery, and it has to be reduced by whatever component of the actual purchase price was due to goodwill.
Yes, except the way the residual method kind of...
Or however you figure it out, because where I'm going with this is, therefore, when you also, the other side of what they're taxed on is what they receive when they sell the asset. So I didn't see where the government was saying that the selling price should be reduced on the same formula. The government wanted to use the actual selling price, which was received, but to reduce the basis on a different formula than the measure of the actual selling price. Is that right?
Both parties have to use the same allocation. So I believe the answer...
So their selling price would also be reduced by whatever value the goodwill had?
No, because goodwill is a component, is one of the assets that's transferred. The question...
Goodwill is part of basis, but the statute only allows them to recover the cost of the tangible assets and not the goodwill, right?
Right, Your Honor. That's the key point here, is that with respect to the residual method, what's important to keep in mind is that they didn't just buy eligible assets. They bought wind farm businesses that included a whole bunch of intangible property, and because they valued the purchase price on the basis of not the assets that they were acquiring, they valued it based on the income streams that they were going to get, because this was an unbelievably predictable business. And so they said, listen, we know we've got all this wind data. We know basically it's a regulated industry. We've got a customer lined up for the next 24 years. They're not going to go bankrupt. They're one of the biggest utilities in the country. And we know what sort of revenue streams we're going to get. And so what plaintiffs were acquiring was not just the assets. They were acquiring an income stream. They were acquiring a business. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you have to segregate, well, what's the fair market value of the individual assets, and what did they acquire that was not Class 5 assets, which would be Class 6 or Class 7, intangibles, and then unidentifiable intangibles, which would be goodwill and going concern.
But if I understand the peculiar circumstances doctrine correctly, when that applies, that the cases say that you use fair market value of the asset, the tangible asset in this case, right?
In terms of the peculiar circumstances, yes. That's an alternative to our first argument. Yes.
But that's what the peculiar circumstances basically says. You use the fair market value in this case for the tangible assets.
Right. Well, peculiar circumstances, just to make sure that...
No, the result. Yeah. The result...
Yes, the result should be the fair market value. It should be reduced down to it,
in order to bring into play the peculiar circumstances doctrine, if I understand it, you have to have two things. One, that the price paid is, I don't know, substantially in excess of fair market value or something like that, and that the parties have an incentive to... misallocate, right?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
No?
I would say that the peculiar circumstances test, in which Lemon is the shining example of what that test is all about, talks about influencing the purchaser to pay in excess of the fair market value. That is what the test is. So it doesn't have to be highly inflated, which is what the Court of Federal Claims applied here. It doesn't have to be the fact that there was undue manipulation. It has to be that the purchaser was influenced to pay in excess of fair market value, which is why peculiar circumstances exist. As a general rule, cost equals basis under the Internal Revenue Code. That's section 1012. The peculiar circumstances exception is when cost isn't the fair market value, because that's the assumption that underlies cost equals basis, is that the cost is the fair market value. We usually let the market dictate what the basis is because that's what people pay.
Let me just tell you what's on my mind. The matter that sticks out for me the most, at least at the moment, is the government subsidy and how that arguably got baked in to the sale price. And so, as I understand your peculiar circumstances argument, with respect to that subsidy, you're not arguing that the subsidy itself is the peculiar circumstance. It's the indemnity?
Correct.
Okay, so then exactly, I can't quite see and understand what is it about the indemnity that causes a peculiar circumstance if it is the case that the subsidy itself is not a peculiar circumstance, and it turns out that the law permits the sale price to be the basis, then the indemnity doesn't matter. You're,
the person is entitled to that high sale price. And then if it turns out that no, it's not going to be the sale price as the basis, but in fact it's going to be this cost method, then again, and the indemnity is going to be irrelevant. So maybe I'm not quite understanding what your indemnity argument is with respect to saying it's a peculiar circumstance, but to me it seems like it, the potential more core peculiar circumstance is the very large government subsidy that arguably itself is getting baked into the sale price.
Right. I see that my time is up, but
no, please answer the question.
The indemnity is the peculiar circumstance. We're asserting the indemnity is a peculiar circumstance here because the indemnity is operating as a classic bootstrap in this instance. The peculiar circumstances has to do, all the peculiar circumstances that we've identified here have to do with sort of a circular cash flow where the plaintiffs have asserted that they've paid X for these wind farm businesses, but then the recipient, TerraGen, is either promised or has promised to make related payments back to the plaintiffs. So the way that it works with the indemnity is the idea is that we're...
Can I simplify this?
Sure.
Like, let's say Toyota sells a car for $25,000.
Right.
And then the government announces and passes a law. Anybody that owns a Toyota is, we're going to give you $10,000. Congratulations, Toyota owners. And then all of a sudden, the Toyota dealerships bump their price up to $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the Toyota dealerships say, anybody that buys a Toyota from us, you know, we promise you're going to get $10,000. It's really the government law that got passed for ordaining that everybody's going to get 10 grand. Yeah. It's not necessarily the indemnity, I don't think, that inflated the sale price of the Toyota from 25 to 30. Am I right or am I wrong about that? What is it about the indemnity that now somehow distorted the sale price? I mean, it seems like it's more the law's passage that gave the Toyota dealerships the opportunity to raise their prices.
I don't disagree with respect to your hypothetical, but there's one key fact that's different from the hypothetical you laid out and the facts of this case, is that in this case, the Section 1603 payment was based on the purchase price. You calculate it based on the allocation of the purchase price to the particular assets.
Okay, so change my hypothetical. You get 30% of 25K or 30% of the sale price.
Yes, and if there was if what Toyota was selling was not just an individual asset, it's not just they didn't just buy a turbine, they bought multiple assets that constituted a wind farm business that you have to make allocations as between eligible and ineligible property. But the bottom line is that by virtue of basically what TerraGen was saying is you agree to this purchase price because it will increase your 1603 payment. And if the government doesn't end up being on the hook for making that full payment, we'll come in and we'll pay you the difference. And so this idea of you pay us $100 million and you put in for a $30 million 1603 payment. But if you don't get a $30 million 1603 payment, if you only get a $15 million 1603 payment, the indemnity kicks in and TerraGen says, we'll pay you the difference. We'll pay you the $15 million.
Could I back you up for just a second? But the contract here between TerraGen and the Alta entities had a single sales price, right, for everything that was being transferred. Am I correct about that?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
And then what happened? Afterwards, KPMG came along, I don't know how long afterwards, and the parties, TerraGen and Alta, the Alta entities retained KPMG to allocate the purchase price. Is that what happened?
In order to make an application for these 1603 payments, you have to have the basis of the eligible property attested to. And so I believe that that's how KPMG became involved in the application process. I don't know whether it was, you know, commensurate with or after the fact, but the bottom line is that
that was the rule. Now, what did KPMG purport to be doing, to be making a determination of the fair market value of the tangible asset?
They did two things. They offered two sort of spreadsheets, if you were. One is that they determined, they vouched for what the costs were. And then the other one is they vouched for the pro rata allocation between they distinguished between eligible property on one side and ineligible property on the other. And so then they determined what that would be and said that it was a reasonable way to allocate basis as between, or allocate the purchase price as between eligible and ineligible property,
so
which is contrary to.
So they didn't do it in terms of fair market value?
They didn't apply the residual method. They claim it's fair market value.
Well, whether it's the residual method or peculiar circumstances, the fair market value test is the test. They didn't purport to be determining the fair market value of the acquired tangible assets.
I believe that they would say that they did purport to, based on this allocation method that they used, yes.
And the allocation method was what?
Was they took the purchase price, they figured out the relative percentage of eligible development and construction costs over the total development and construction costs for each of these businesses. And then they multiplied that percentage based on the purchase price and said that's allocable to the eligible assets, and everything else is ineligible assets, which doesn't allow for.
But did they pay any attention to the value, the fair market value of turbines and all the assets that were included here?
Like the fungible, like how much would it cost to buy a turbine from the company? No.
So then how was it they were doing fair market value if they didn't look to the market value of the acquired assets?
Well, I would imagine what they're going to say is they started by looking at, in order to determine the percentage.
No, I'm asking your view of it. Why is this?
I agree with you. They did not determine. They completely departed from the actual cost of the assets.
Or the fair market value of the assets.
Yes. I mean, they said everything. They said basically the costs, in each case, they said that the eligible assets are the cost plus whatever the allocable portion of what's left over.
As they backed out land and a few other things which were specifically not qualified assets.
And then they just spread the excess purchase price amongst all the assets. That's exactly what they did.
But before you go, let me just ask another question. For your residual method, for Parsons' cost method, is there any analysis involved in potentially backing out the subsidy? Or is that just something that you don't really think about or even worry about, because really all you're trying to do is just calculate the cost or fair market value of the individual turbines, et cetera?
That I think is the answer, is that because ultimately the question here is their basis in the eligible property, what Parsons, what the government is concerned with is looking at that component of it. So you don't...
You didn't argue below that the government subsidy itself is a peculiar circumstance. Is that fair?
That is correct. We didn't argue. What we argued was the indemnifications which guaranteed them a particular subsidy payment.
So
is what is...
On that theory, there'd be no capital gain at all, because all that they were selling were the used turbines, which couldn't be worth as much as they were when they were originally purchased.
No, Your Honor, because they're going to say that they paid a tremendous amount of tax on this, because remember that if you add up all the costs, it comes up to only 60% of what they got for these wind farms. So they this was a huge, great deal for TerraGen.
But
they ended
saying
up
saying that's not enough.
But the thing is that they didn't allocate appropriately those they didn't determine what the proper basis of the eligible assets compared to the entire wind farms were. They shoehorned all the value into the tangible eligible assets and basically said there's nothing left for all these intangible and what these plaintiffs were actually purchasing, which was these revenue streams.
So you're saying they paid no tax?
No, Terrigen attests that they paid a lot of tax, but the thing is that they paid tax on...
This isn't a question of the tax to them.
Yeah.
It's a question of how to calculate the grant, which they get only for the tangible assets.
Correct. And
well, of course, it has to be a question. Well, that's equivalent. I think we have the position.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll reserve the rest of my time for questions.
Mr. Rosenbaum.
Your Honor, let me start with the question that you all asked a number of questions about, which is how do you treat the cash grant? You didn't see a significant briefing of that because the government did not argue to this court that the error was including the value of the cash grant as...
Perhaps not, but the cash grant would be backed out under the fair market value methodology.
Well, but let me just say, the law is crystal clear that the cash...
No, but is that not correct?
No, absolutely not correct, Your Honor.
That under their computation it's backed out?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because the law is perfectly clear that the value... The tax, be it a tax credit or whatever, it is considered part of the value.
No, that's your argument about how it should be considered. What I'm asking is whether Parsons' calculation using the cost method was just the cost of the assets, and it wouldn't include the value of the government grant.
I would not characterize that as the approach that he took, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, because what he did is he looked at the cost of Terrigen to construct the facility plus what he thought was a reasonable developer fee on top of that. That's how he did it.
Can we just assume for the moment that Terrigen had qualified for the 1603 cash grant and thus never sold the farms? What would the basis of the farms have been in that instance?
Sure.
How would one go about calculating the basis for Terrigen?
Right. The basis is the cost to the taxpayer under any circumstance. If Terrigen were the taxpayer, then it would have been their cost to construct the facility. Just like if someone were to build a house.
So it would be the cost method.
Well, no, that would be considered, well, that would, their cost, it's what they paid. But remember, plaintiffs here are buying property. The cost to them is what they paid when they bought the facility.
I'm just trying to think through my hypothetical. Terrigen bought these farms for something like $400 million and then put some money into it.
Yes.
Right? And then the law gets passed in 2009. Everybody gets 30% of their basis. Congratulations. Now how does Terrigen, assuming it qualified, calculate its basis?
Terrigen's basis would be whatever their out-of-pocket costs were. And they, of course, would pay no income tax at that point of any kind.
I think the point is that if Terrigen had applied for the grant itself,
yes,
if it hadn't had this, what you characterize as problem because of ownership by nonprofits, the grant to Terrigen would have been materially lower than the grant to the Alta entities, correct?
But yes, Your Honor, but that's the same in any transaction.
How could it be that Congress would intend that the grant should be inflated because there was a sale of the property?
Because that's how every transaction works, Your Honor. If I build a building myself, I claim depreciation based upon my out-of-pocket expenses.
We're talking about incentives that are being created by this statute. Why would it be that Congress would want to inflate the value of the grant just because people entered into a purchase and sale transaction?
Because it's not being inflated, Your Honor.
It's not?
No, you absolutely...
You said it was hugely increased.
It is. That's because, and Your Honor, if I build a building myself and it costs me, but Your Honor, let me just, because, and it costs me $80 million to build it, I depreciate based upon the $80 million. If I qualify for an investment tax credit, I do it based upon the $80 million. If rather than holding ownership, I sell it to someone else for $100 million, that person claims depreciation on $100 million. They claim the investment tax credit on $100 million. Yeah, Congress had no intention.
I think you're not addressing my question. Here's a special program designed to create grants in lieu of tax credits to encourage people to build these wind farms, to buy the turbines, to do the asset, to acquire the assets necessary to do that. How could it be that Congress would want the basis of those assets for purposes of the calculation of the grant to be increased just because people engaged in a sale transaction? So that if TerraGen itself had applied for the grant, the number would be $100 million. But if they sell it to somebody else, suddenly the grant is $300 million. Why does that fit into the purposes of this program?
The purpose of the program was to duplicate what already existed under the investment tax credit. And for that's absolutely clear. This was not a new program. This was a program that substituted for a certain period of time a cash grant in lieu of an investment tax credit, but based on the same precepts that would be used for both. And in an investment tax credit context, basis is what the taxpayer paid for the property that constitutes, that gives rise to the tax credit. And if the person built it themselves, what they paid out of pocket to build it themselves is their basis. If they purchase it, it's what they paid to purchase it. And the offsetting, why would Congress have this system in place? Because they know that if there is a sale at a higher price than what the cost was to the original developer, that developer will pay tax on the delta between the two, which will offset which offsets entirely.
Can I go back?
Of course, Your Honor.
Toyota analogy.
Yes. Well, so you're.
I'm not done.
All right, please.
Okay, Toyota. They sell their cars for $25,000.
Yes.
And then the government passes a law. Anybody that owns a Toyota, we're going to pay you $10,000. Toyota all of a sudden starts selling their Toyotas for $30,000. And of course, a lot of people maybe that wouldn't have bought the Toyotas are now buying the Toyotas. Doesn't the rebate law that Congress passed cause people to buy the Toyotas at an inflated price above the fair market value?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, please just
fair market value. The black letter law is that fair market value is established by arm's length negotiations. What a willing buyer will pay a willing seller, and what a willing buyer will pay a willing seller for property is affected almost always by considerations of the law. Take a recent example. There's now limited deductibility as to property taxes. That just happened. You read in the newspapers, that may have a depressing impact on housing prices because you no longer qualify for that. What people pay for their homes or willing to pay for their homes may go down as a result. What they pay for that house is still the fair market value of the house. When they go to pay property taxes...
Your problem is that the statute provides a grant based on the value of the tangible assets and not something else like the rebate.
And that gets to the question, how has the law treated that issue? And this is not materially briefed because the government did not raise this issue in its pleadings to the court except tangentially in the reply brief. It is dealt with at length in our findings of fact and conclusion of law, which is docket 158, paragraphs 258 to 64. But as an example, in the Sachs decision by the Ninth Circuit, the court said investors may take depreciation deductions and tax credits based upon the purchase price they pay, even though what they paid was anticipation of those benefits. That is on all fours with the questions that the court is asking. The ITNS decision, a tax court decision by 1991, Sachs is 69 F3rd 982 at 991. ITNS is 97 Tax Court 496 at 532 note 28. Quote, tax court, the Supreme Court has recognized that the tax savings generated by an asset can be an identifiable component of its value. Its, meaning of the asset's value. And we all know from buying houses ourselves that, as an example, the deductibility of property taxes is an influence, as is the ability to deduct the
you're not addressing the purpose of this statute. Where you're arguing that the grant ought to be based on the value, that the existence of the grant ought to increase the grant. And it's difficult to see that that's what Congress intended here.
Congress intended that whatever happened, Congress said the grant will be based upon the basis of the property. And it said that we want this to mean the exact same thing it already means for purposes of the investment tax credit. The law is crystal clear. I've provided some examples of how the courts have dealt with this issue. There are many other examples. It's uniformly the case that one includes in the value of the property whatever benefits come along with those property. And in this particular case, it was only the eligible property that qualified for the cash grant. So by definition, the benefits here are associated with the eligible property. And this would be exactly how it would have worked had the cash grant program not been enacted and instead these people qualified for and sought investment tax credits. And that hasn't changed at all.
When it comes to the government's proposed residual method, they seem to be looking at that, approaching it from the ground up, right? Going through the classes and from the ground up, trying to build up what is the appropriate basis. And the trial court seemed to look at it maybe more from the top down. Let's start with your sale price, and now let's see if things like goodwill and going concern value can be backed out from that sale price and then made findings that there wasn't enough here to prove up that those things existed or of any real value. Yes. So I'm just wondering, is that the right way to look at it, going from the top down rather than from the ground up?
I would describe it a little differently, Your Honor, as follows. The trial court definitely started with a proposition that we think is unassailable, that basis is determined, is the same as fair market value, and fair market value is determined by the price established by arm's length negotiations. So if one of these facilities transacted at $560 million, that's the fair market value. And then the question becomes, of course, well, what was in that transaction? And if you assume 1060 applies, and we have some arguments that it doesn't, but let's assume 1060 does apply, you have to allocate the purchase price to the various asset classes. So what the judge said is, let's see which asset classes were actually transferred as part of this transaction. Now, the waterfall will tell you how you allocate the purchase price sequentially, but the first thing is, does it exist? Use an easy example. Class one is cash. You know, was any cash transferred? If the answer is no, then obviously there's nothing to allocate to class one. You don't worry about the order in which you do it. He went through all the classes, and he determined, and there was oodles of testimony on this, that there were no classes other than class five,
okay,
which is tangible property.
The problem with that is that he excluded the Parsons testimony. If we were to hold that he made an error in doing that, then your purported factual findings would have to be set aside so that the entirety of the testimony would be considered, right?
Well, Your Honor, we think otherwise because what Parsons did is say, I will just consider there to be goodwill or going concern value without applying any definitions as to what those terms mean. I'll just call that the money that's left over.
But that's an argument that's not been briefed on appeal. What I'm saying is, let us say that the trial judge made an error in not listening to Parsons' explanation, or that he made an error in excluding the testimony entirely, and he should have taken it for what it was worth. Then we have a potential conflict in testimony between the P, your accountants, and Dr. Parsons, right?
I would say not, Your Honor. If one looks at those materials, then one, if one concludes that there is no goodwill or going concern value by definition, based upon the considerations that were applied by Judge Wheeler, then there is nothing left over that could possibly be put into a class other than Class 5. And that's the fundamental conclusion that Judge Wheeler reached based upon the testimony was
based
that...
Based on the testimony, that's the problem.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I would submit, and of course, be happy to talk about the correctness of Judge Wheeler's decision as to Dr. Parsons, but beyond that, our view is that if that these facilities had not gone into operation yet, that there cannot be goodwill or going concern value under those circumstances, and we believe those are true both factually and as a matter of law based upon these courts' precedents, and if that is correct, then there is nothing for Dr. Parsons to be addressing. If no one disagrees that these facilities had not gone into operation at the time when they were purchased by the plaintiffs. This court in the Don case, relying upon precedent by the tax court as well, has said that goodwill and going concern value have a time component. They're only built up as you operate over time.
And so
that's the direct answer to your question is, Your Honor, if you agree with that, then there is no, okay. You would
is
not remand
it
anyway.
Is your view that the trial court made a legal ruling or a fact finding on going concern value?
I think he did both. I mean, he was applying what he understood to be the legal test, and he analyzed a number of facts and said, based upon those facts, okay. I conclude that it doesn't exist. He did place a special emphasis on the fact that there is no, they had not gone into operations. We think as a matter of law, that's enough to conclude that there's no goodwill or going concern value, but he looked at additional facts as well.
So for the residual method, there's also Class 6 intangibles.
Yes.
So is there potential for value to be
and
put into that bucket?
And that was addressed too, Your Honor. And the answer to that is no. And I'll get to why Dr. Parsons is irrelevant as to that as well, but the law is perfectly, a contract can be a Class 6 asset, but only if it's above market. The law is very clear on that point. There was copious testimony that none of the contracts here were above market, and therefore none of them qualified as separate assets. That was the conclusion that had been reached by KPMG originally, and one of the questions was, what did KPMG do? One of the things, KPMG was looking for assets to which the purchase price might properly be allocated. And they talked about goodwill and going concern value and concluded there wasn't any. They looked at all these other potential assets and found they didn't exist. That was confirmed by what I'll call non-class five assets and concluded there weren't any. If Dr. Parsons, for example, had said, oh, I've identified certain contracts that I think are above market, well, that would have been additional factual information that his exclusion kept from being before the court. But he didn't provide anything like that, Your Honor. And so, once again, we see no condition under which Judge Wheeler's decision would be changed. Fundamentally, the waterfall tells you in what order you assign the purchase price, but the waterfall doesn't tell you which buckets exist. That's a separate inquiry. That's the inquiry that Judge Wheeler took. That's the inquiry KPMG had taken at the time that initial allocation was done. And the conclusion reached was there were no other classes.
So I guess the so-called waterfall method, you're going through, you're trying to figure out how to assign different chunks of the purchase price to the, you know, tangible assets and things like that. And then what we have here is a large, perhaps arguable remaining chunk of the sale price that that maybe doesn't quite fit into the remaining classes?
Well,
whether it's six or seven?
No, Your Honor.
Going concern?
No. Contracts?
So then what do we do in that kind of circumstance?
Well, there's nothing left over, Your Honor. I mean, that's, you know, the purchase price has told you what the fair market value is of the assets that were transferred. That's not leaving aside their peculiar...
But the residual method then obligates and requires all of us to now divvy it up into these different classes.
Into the assets, into the classes of assets that actually exist. And so, as to use my example again, if class one doesn't exist, nothing gets allocated to it. If goodwill and going concern value don't exist, which is class seven, nothing gets allocated to it. If there are no contracts that are above market or other things that would qualify as a intangible other than goodwill and going concern value, then nothing gets attributed to class six.
So then which class enjoys the benefit of receiving all of the value of the sale price in case it doesn't fit into any other class?
Class five. But, I mean, in the sense that class five would capture any asset not otherwise identified. That's the definition of class five. But in this case, of course...
Any asset, including intangible assets?
No, Your Honor. Well, the phraseology is, I think, any asset not otherwise identified. I mean, if you
would identify... But there are other categories after class five that deal with intangibles.
Yes, and you would put those in... If you had identified another intangible, that would be class six. We agree with that, but there was a particular... You know, there are tests for determining... I mean, the principal indicia that the government points to is the existence of contracts, and there's a particular legal test as to whether or not a contract can be an intangible, no question about that, but it is a prerequisite, which is that it be above market. Otherwise, it's not deemed to be a separate intangible. This was addressed at great length and considered by the judge, and I think the law is straightforward on that point. So these are issues on which great deference is owed to the judge's factual findings. This is a clearly erroneous review.
The benefit of Parsons' testimony.
Well, and that is, and his decision to exclude Dr. Parsons is not only subject to abuse of discretion standard, but because...
What case says that you can exclude someone's testimony on the ground that he's a perjurer without giving him an opportunity to explain?
Well, I think... The judge found that
one case.
Your Honor, it is. He made a factual finding that he had.
What case?
He testified.
What case?
I think Unisys says that if a judge reaches the conclusion that the expert had engaged in serial perjury, that is a basis
without giving the witness an opportunity to explain.
Your Honor, he gave explanations in the course of his testimony
If it looks as if we need additional briefing on that point, if it turns out to be dispositive, we will say so. Any more questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rosenbaum. Mr. Weiner, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Judge Newman. Just a couple of points that I'd like to make on rebuttal. One is that here the government asserted that there are about all of Class 5, Class 6, and Class 7 assets, including Class 6 assets being the Section 197 intangibles. And Dr. Parsons did directly speak to two of the big ones, which would be the power purchase agreements and the interconnection agreements. And I would also refer you to when TerraGen had actually purchased the wind farms from Alco, and Duff and Phelps, another accounting firm or valuation firm, did a valuation. They put considerable value to the interconnection agreements, basically saying, look, let's value what the businesses acquired with the interconnection agreements, and then let's value without the interconnection agreements. And the delta was the value that they ascribed.
And so here it is highly relevant that Dr. Parsons got excluded. As well, we disagree with plaintiff's counsel that that what a court should do is to try to figure out whether there's goodwill or going concern value, and if it can't identify it, then we can't allocate anything to that bucket. That's contrary to the residual method, and it puts the cart before the horse. Part of what the residual method is designed to do is to figure out whether the unidentifiable assets of residual of goodwill and going concern value actually exist. And if you can't substantiate the fair market value of the Class 5 assets as being the full purchase price, then the residual method requires you to allocate those either in Class 6 or Class 7.
Why not Class 5? If it doesn't fit very well in any other bucket, that's what Class 5 is for, right?
No, the assets themselves, that's what Class 5 is for. The value is what we're talking about, the purchase price. The idea being is that the value of those assets that do not belong in any other class belong in Class 5, and so you determine what the fair market value is.
But even if some of these assets, in addition to the tangible assets, fit within Class 5, the statute doesn't say you get a grant based on Class 5. It says you get a grant based on the value of the tangible assets.
Right. And again, within Class 5, then you have to allocate between eligible and ineligible, which is, I think, also the fundamental point. What plaintiff's counsel keeps asserting is that, well, if I sell a house, the house is whatever the fair market value is. But here, they didn't just sell a house. They sold a myriad of assets, including both tangible and intangible. So that only begs the question. The question is, how do you allocate that purchase price among the assets acquired? And so these examples of a house don't really help. And then finally, I would just say one thing about...
one more sentence. We're well over time.
Okay. Is that I would just refer Judge Chen to the Van Duzer case, which is helpful, I believe, in terms of the tax benefit and indemnities. Here, what you didn't have is... Here, they guaranteed a particular tax... They guaranteed a particular subsidy, which influenced the purchase price. In Van Duzer, which was a different scenario, there was no guarantee. They just basically said, "We're going to give you a working facility," and there was an expectation of tax benefits to come from that. But there were no guaranteed payments coming from the seller to the purchaser. That's what makes this a peculiar circumstance. And in conclusion, we ask that you reverse. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both. The case is taken under submission.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.